Ruined castles, ghostly secrets, blood-stained daggers, dark dungeons, and fainting damsels in distress pursued by demonic villains. Welcome to the world of gothic novels. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. Why did gothic novels become popular in 18th century England, and what aspects of them continued into the following centuries, including our own time? Joining me to discuss gothic novels is Mark Vareski, professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and the author of Everywhere and Nowhere, Anonymity and Mediation in 18th Century England. Welcome to University of the Air.
Very happy to be here, Emily.
Gothic, that's a term that we hear everywhere, whether it's dressing goth or, you know, gothic scary movies or gothic romances. Tell us about the origin of this term and why you're interested in it.
The history of the term gothic is really wild. So originally it comes to refer to the Visigoths, and by the 18th century it's any Germanic tribe. And then it refers to architecture. Gothic architecture is really the kind of medieval architecture that I think we've come to recognize as being either really spooky or the thing that we see churches. Or a lot of Ivy League campuses, actually, is where we see a lot of Gothic architecture today.
And it would be kind of the opposite, maybe, of the classical Parthenon, you know, Bascom Hill Capitol building look. It's something that's spookier and more, you know, wild. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. So Bascom Hill is in the neoclassical style. We have the columns. We have kind of like very nice straight angles. And the Gothic is arches and spires and this very kind of like complex, ornate kind of architecture. And so in the 18th century, neoclassicism was very much the architectural and literary style. And then somewhere around mid-century, artists, architects, philosophers, legal scholars start thinking about and reevaluating the medieval past. So first it happens in architecture. You start to have this Gothic revival in building. And then it happens in the 1760s in literature and just kind of takes off from there.
Can you tell us about the figure of Horace Walpole?
Oh, Horace Walpole is bananas. So he was the son of Robert Walpole, the first British prime minister. And he was an eccentric fellow, to say the least. And so in 1749, he gets this rather humble estate, humble by, you know, 18th century standards, called Strawberry Hill. And over the next 30 years, rebuilds it into a Gothic castle.
Do we know why?
Because he was
eccentric.
Oh, yeah, an eccentric rich guy.
But why in decorating his estate as a sort of Gothic castle? Do we have any sense psychologically of what he was trying? Was he trying to be scary, funny, a rebel against law and order and, you know, square boxes? What do we know about his thinking in doing it?
I think it's a little bit of rebellion. I also think there's something about, right, if the Gothic revival is really just starting to kick off mid-century, he's kind of at the vanguard. He's, you know, he's an early goth in the kind of like mall goth sense of the term.
Sometimes when we hear the term Gothic, we might think of Dracula or Frankenstein, Phantom of the Opera, later works. But everywhere you look, when you're looking at Gothic novel definitions, they point to Horace Walpole's book, The Castle of Otranto, as the first Gothic novel.
Yeah.
Why?
Because Horace Walpole called it a Gothic story. So the first edition is published in 1764, and he tries to pass it off as a translation. The second edition comes...
A translation from the medieval, kind of, as if it's an actual manuscript from earlier?
Or... Yeah. He says, oh, I've found this ancient Italian manuscript. It's from, you know, a very ancient house in Naples, and I've translated it. And then the second edition comes out in the next year, and he's like, actually, I wrote it. But what's really significant is the subtitle is A Gothic Story. So Walpole is the first to append this word Gothic to literature, and it really sets some of the key features of the genre.
How did his father, the prime minister, feel about his son publishing a Gothic novel?
That's a really good question. I can't say I know.
Okay. I just wondered if that was considered a bit beyond the pale. So I wonder if you could share the opening of Castle of Otranto. It's not something most of us read regularly, but if this is sort of the motherlode for the beginning of the Gothic novel, I wonder if you could take us through the opening chapter, set it up, read parts, and talk about what makes it Gothic.
Absolutely. And I'd also say, read Castle of Otranto. It's incredibly short. You can put it away in a few hours. And it is wonderfully weird. Manfred, Prince of Otranto, had one son and one daughter. The latter, a most beautiful virgin, aged 18, was called Matilda. Conrad, the son, was 3 years younger, a homely youth, sickly and of no promising disposition. Yet he was the darling of his father, who never showed any symptoms of affection to Matilda. Manfred had contracted a marriage for his son with the Marquis of Vincenza's daughter, Isabella, and she had already been delivered by her guardians into the hands of Manfred, that he might celebrate the wedding as soon as Conrad's infirm state of health would permit. Manfred's impatience for the ceremonial was remarked by his family and neighbors. The former, indeed, apprehending the severity of their prince's disposition, did not dare to utter their surmises on this precipitation. Hippolyta, his wife, an amiable lady, did sometimes venture to represent the danger of marrying their only son so early, considering his great youth and greater infirmities, but she never received any other answer than reflections on her own sterility, who had given him but one heir. His tenants and subjects were less cautious in their discourses. They attributed this hasty wedding to the prince's dread of seeing accomplished an ancient prophecy, which was said to have pronounced that the castle and lordship of Otranto should pass from the present family whenever the real owner should be grown too large to inhabit it. It was difficult to make any sense of this prophecy, and still less easy to conceive what it had to do with the marriage in question. Yet these mysteries, or contradictions, did not make the populace adhere the less to their opinion.
And before we keep going with this opening chapter, let's look at what we already see there. So you got a royal family with some problems.
Absolutely. And I think one of the key things is this is not a novel set in England, and it's not a novel set in the 18th century. Up to this point, what novel readers expected of the novel was really, by mid-century, the novel is a novel about us. It's about the contemporary 18th century, and it's about English people doing really kind of everyday things. So Walpole's already moving us in a different direction, setting the novel in the past, somewhere around the Crusades, he never really tells us, setting it in Italy rather than England. So we're in a very different world, which sets us up for things like mysterious prophecies.
So you have a cursed family in a castle with a sickly son. Then what happens?
Oh, I'll tell you. Young Conrad's birthday was fixed for the espousals. The company was assembled in the chapel of the castle and everything ready for beginning the divine office when Conrad himself was missing. Manfred, impatient of the least delay and who had not observed his son retire, dispatched one of his attendants to summon the young prince. The servant, who had not stayed long enough to have crossed the court to Conrad's apartment, came running back breathless in a frantic manner, his eyes staring and foaming at the mouth. He said nothing but pointed to the court. The company were struck with terror and amazement. The Princess Hippolyta, without knowing what was the matter, but anxious for her son, swooned away. Manfred, less apprehensive than enraged at the procrastination of the nuptials and at the folly of his domestic, asked imperiously what was the matter. The fellow made no answer, but continued pointing towards the courtyard, and at last, after repeated questions put to him, cried out, "Oh, the helmet! The helmet!" In the meantime, some of the company had run into the court, from whence was heard a confused noise of shrieks, horror, and surprise. Manfred, who began to be alarmed at not seeing his son, went himself to get information of what occasioned this strange confusion. Matilda remained endeavoring to assist her mother, and Isabella stayed for the same purpose, and to avoid showing any impatience for the bridegroom, for whom, in truth, she had conceived little affection. The first thing that struck Manfred's eyes was a group of his servants endeavoring to raise something that appeared to him a mountain of sable plumes. He gazed without believing his sight. "What are ye doing?" cried Manfred wrathfully. "Where is my son?" A volley of cries, voices replied, "Oh, my lord, the prince, the helmet, the helmet." Shocked with these lamentable sounds and dreading he knew not what, he advanced hastily. But what a sight for a father's eyes! He beheld his child dashed to pieces and almost buried underneath an enormous helmet, 100 times more large than any casque ever made for human being, and shaded with a proportionate quantity of black feathers. The horror of the spectacle, the ignorance of all around, how this misfortune had happened, and all above all, the tremendous phenomenon before him, took away the prince's speech. Yet his silence lasted longer than even grief could occasion. He fixed his eyes on what he wished in vain to believe a vision, and seemed less attentive to his loss than buried in meditation on the stupendous object that had occasioned it. He touched, he examined the fatal casque, nor could even the bleeding, mangled remains of the young prince divert the eyes of Manfred from the portent before him.
That's a horrible scene there. So you've got this giant helmet that kills his son that was supposed to get married, and he's now mangled and bloody and dead.
Yeah. This is the first two pages of the novel, and I find it so remarkable.
And what are the things that stand out to you as remarkable besides that it's wild here?
Well, one, just the sheer spectacle. Right, I don't think that we're accustomed to novels opening up with one of the key characters being, as we often describe in my classroom, being splatted. And two, just the sheer size of this helmet.
100 times bigger than, you know, than a casque or something. So it's a giant helmet.
Yeah, right. So we know we're not in the realm of the everyday.
We're in the realm of nightmares because, if I remember right, Walpole said this started, in fact, from a dream he had.
Yes.
With a big helmet. So we're in a nightmare world.
We're in a nightmare world, and we're also in a world where there's something about both the size of the helmet that seems almost inconceivable, right? We kind of see it, the speech, right, the absence of, like, grammatical sentences. Everyone's saying, the prince, the helmet, right? It's almost indescribable. So there's the size, right? There's a kind of a sublimity of it, right? It's too much for everyone to take in.
And the reference there to a portent, it seems that Gothic novels use omens and signs and portents and, you know, something that's like a glimpse from the supernatural, some kind of message that's hidden there.
Absolutely, right? No one knows what this means. But Manfred, because he knows the prophecy, this helmet is too big for this castle. And the prophecy is about its true inhabitant growing too large. Right? He knows, and this is part of why he's almost kind of distant or absent from this scene, he knows that this might be the fulfillment of the prophecy.
And doesn't Manfred, after the death of his son, then set his eyes on marrying Isabella himself? And isn't that a little bit perverted?
Oh, it absolutely is. Gothic fiction is perhaps above all forms of fiction the most conventional. So we'll see kind of reoccurring tropes. So darkness, kind of like huge, mysterious beings, helmets. But one of the other, and this is, I think, one of the darker and, I think, more difficult tropes that the Gothic gives us is the trope of incest. Manfred pursues the woman who should be his daughter-in-law. Other novels will explore plots of accidental incest, or where characters think they might have had an intimate relationship with a sibling, but it doesn't quite come to pass. So Walpole's seeding the ground for the shape that the Gothic takes in really the coming centuries.
If we're trying to figure out why are we so fascinated with haunted houses and Halloween spooky things and movies where just the soundtrack alone, you can recognize, oh, something's bad is about to happen. This idea that there's going to be a creaking door and behind it will be something that scares us. You know, these signs from the supernatural, ghosts and all kinds of, why are we, would you say, so fascinated with that?
And in part to answer that, I think I want to think through the 18th century aesthetic theorists that were really influential. So people like Edmund Burke or David Hume. So Hume lays out in his philosophical inquiry into the beautiful and the sublime, the ideas of suddenness being frightening to us, but in that frightening, we get a bit of the sublime, right? We're taken out of ourselves for a moment. And so that's scary, but it's also a bit transcendent. If we think about something like going to a horror movie and the jump scare, we jump out of our seat. That was scary, but there's a little bit of what Burke would call delight.
Adrenaline rush or?
The adrenaline rush, I think the little bit of being outside of ourselves, of transcending ourselves, of being just so fully in that moment that we're not thinking about our errands we have to run or our shopping list. We're just...
So it's transcending the prosaic, mundane life and for a moment thinking there's something supernatural or something that we just don't have any control or understanding of?
Or maybe even not thinking, right? There's mm-hmm. something about like the unthought of just being totally scared. But also, right, we know we're in the movie theater or we know we're reading Castle of Otranto. So there are confines, right?
Would you say that part of it is too just the way we have to come to terms with death? You know, it seems Gothic novels have so many things where you've got a decaying, ruined castle. And then as with this, you've got the decaying prince, the son that's infirm. You know, you've got this notion of being killed and it can happen any time, whether it's this mysterious illness or some kind of accident, giant helmet falling on you, or, you know, just that we all are facing the unknown in terms of our own mortality. Will it happen today that we end our life or will it be later? To what extent do Gothic novels force us to confront mortality?
I mean, I think all literature forces us to confront mortality. I do think the Gothic stylizes it in such a way that we can confront it. We can recognize it as, you know, this is mediated by literature, this is mediated by film. So it's kind of protective.
I'm just thinking about how the Goth style of dress is always black. You know, there's this, it seems there's this attraction to the dark side, to the deadly, to the, you know, something afterlife or close to that border.
Absolutely. But they're all controlled. And I think that's really important, right? We can take pleasure or delight in reading about Conrad being crushed by the helmet because we know we're in the confines of fiction. Or we know, right, to think about like Gothic dress styles, right? We're confined by fashion.
Would you say there's a thin line between a Gothic novel like Castle of Otranto and pornography?
That's a fascinating question. I do think the Gothic is interested in titillation.
And it seems so often that the scenes involve, you know, a fair young maiden facing kidnapping or rape or incest or something. It's sort of pushing beyond respectable behavior.
Oh, entirely. I mean, one of the hallmarks of the Gothic novel, and we have it in Castle of Otranto, and really every Gothic novel that follows from it, and honestly, every horror movie that follows after it, the idea of a young woman in peril. By the time we get to Matthew Lewis's The Monk in the 1790s, that is kind of quasi-pornography. Matthew Lewis is absolutely reveling in the ways that his female characters are made vulnerable.
And I think it's Edgar Allan Poe that said something like, "There's nothing more poetical than the death of a beautiful woman." You know, so you sort of take something like a beautiful, young, fertile woman, and then you superimpose that with death, and that provides the greatest contrast, like a young woman buried alive, that sort of thing.
Well, absolutely. And if we think about, to go back to Burke, right, the poles of the sublime and the beautiful, for Burke, right, the female form is the essence of beauty. And so the sublime is dark, mysterious, foreboding, intermittent, right? So part of, I think, why the Gothic is so attractive, certainly to readers of the 18th century, but also to viewers and readers today, is because it gives us that really firm contrast between these things that are terrifying and transcendent, but also things that might be beautiful.
What happens when women start writing Gothic novels? We're going to look at the queen of Gothic novels, Anne Radcliffe, when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. Indeed, I am almost weary of the terrible. I have been reviewing The Monk, The Italian, many books, all of which dungeons and old castles and solitary houses by the seaside and caverns and woods and extraordinary characters and all the tribe of horror and mystery have crowded on me. That's Samuel Taylor Coleridge complaining about the outpouring of publishing romance Gothic novels in the 1790s. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Mark Vareski, and we are talking about Gothic novels. We were talking about Horace Walpole and his Castle of Otranto as sort of the original book that called itself a Gothic story. Can you talk about the proliferation of Gothic novels after that, and in particular, Anne Radcliffe?
Yes. I mean, it's an interesting story. So Castle of Otranto comes out. It's published in 1764. And then the Gothic doesn't catch on. Castle of Otranto is popular, goes into several editions. But it's not until a decade later that we get another novel that identifies itself as Gothic. And that's Clara Reeves, the old English baron. And she tries to fix the problems with Castle of Otranto. But it's really in the 1790s where the Gothic picks up steam, and particularly with the novels of Anne Radcliffe, who became, I would say she was the Stephen King of the late 18th century. She's incredibly popular, incredibly influential, and she just wrote a lot of novels.
Any thought on why in the 1790s that became popular? What's happening historically in England that would make people gravitate toward Gothic novels?
There's a couple of things, right? So I talked a little bit about the Gothic revival in the mid-century, and that really hits when we have the emergence of the Romantic movement in the late 1780s and early 1790s, and the Romantics loved the medieval and loved kind of reimagining the medieval. And they also loved ruins, ruined abbeys, ruined castles, right? These became these incredible picturesque scenes for meditating about life, meditating about death, meditating about beauty. So we have a kind of aesthetic revolution that's happening mostly in poetry. And Anne Radcliffe comes along, and she's writing about ruins. She's writing about landscapes. She's writing about all these things that resonate with the Romantic movement, even if her Gothic novels, I would say, are almost the flip side of the Romantic movement, right? This isn't necessarily about beauty. This is about decay. It's about danger.
It's still about emotion, feeling, right? So it's rather than I think, therefore I am, it's more I feel. Therefore I am, or maybe I feel terror and awe, therefore I am reading Gothic novels.
So much about feeling. Anne Radcliffe's novels are full of people having all the feelings all the time. They are afraid. They are moved by the vista of the Pyrenees or the Alps they've seen. They are enamored with the glowworms they saw in their backyard. Her characters are in the world and in their feelings in this very, very profound way.
This is a time where it's not that common for women to publish using their own names. There's a lot of pressure not to, you know, the sort of feeling that women shouldn't be writing books. How does Anne Radcliffe handle that?
It's interesting. So it's actually a little bit of a complicated story. So my first book was about anonymity. And there is a sense that for a woman to publish in her own name is risque. At the same time, by the 1780s and 1790s, to publish a novel by a lady or to publish under a woman's name actually enhances your readership. So we're in this moment where both things can be true, right? To publish as a woman might be looked down on, but to publish as a woman might actually help your readership. Because so many readers by the end of the 18th century were young women. And young women loved Gothic novels. Young men did too, but the story about the Gothic and the kind of the backlash to the Gothic novel is, oh, these are silly novels read by silly little girls.
Kind of the way there's the same attitude towards grocery store harlequin romances. Is it that sort of, you know, feeling that, oh, that's what women do, is read those?
Absolutely. And I would say a lot of what we see in like the harlequin romance, the obsession with some distant past, with pirates or knights, comes out of the Gothic. I think, and I'm not a big reader of harlequin romances, but I think a lot of the romance genre draws the same energy, I would say, from the 18th century Gothic.
So take us into the world of Anne Radcliffe. Get us into one of her books.
Yeah. So I'm going to read a bit from Radcliffe's Romance of the Forest, which is her third novel, published in 1791. And it's my favorite Radcliffe novel.
Why?
I just think, one, it's shorter than Mistress of Udolpho. Mistress of Udolpho is around 600 pages. It's a sweeping novel. Romance of the Forest is a lot more compact, and I think it also establishes a lot of the tropes that we associate with horror. So one of the tropes we'll see in this one is that, oh, our car broke down by the spooky house, I guess we'll have to spend the night. So Radcliffe is, I think, a master of setting the scene and of establishing kind of an ambient feeling of horror.
So tell us sort of the characters and setting before we hear a reading from this.
Yeah. So the main character, or one of the main characters of Romance of the Forest, is this guy named Pierre Lamont. And Pierre Lamont and his wife have had to leave Paris very quickly because they're kind of running from the law, running from creditors. And in their escape, they have gone to this house in the woods. And for some reason that's not revealed in the early part of the novel, they've had to take this young woman, Adeline, with them. So at this point in the novel, Pierre and Lady Lamont and Adeline and their servant, Peter, are traveling through the forest.
In the dark. Of course.
Always. Terrible idea in the 18th century, terrible idea in the 16th century in which this novel is set, but nonetheless they're doing it. And they've stopped at a ruined abbey, and Pierre Lamont is looking and exploring the abbey. The deepening gloom now reminded Lamont that he had no time to lose, but curiosity prompted him to explore further, and he obeyed the impulse. As he walked over the broken pavement, the sound of his steps ran in echoes through the place and seemed like the mysterious accents of the dead, reproving the sacrilegious mortal who thus dared to disturb their precincts. From this chapel he passed into the nave of the great church, of which one window, more perfect than the rest, opened upon a long vista of the forest, through which was seen the rich coloring of evening, melting by imperceptible gradations into the solemn gray of upper air. Dark hills, whose outline appeared distinct upon the vivid glow of the horizon, closed the perspective. Several of the pillars, which had once supported the roof, remained the proud effigies of sinking greatness, and seemed to nod at every murmur of the blast over the fragments of those that had fallen a little bit before them. Lamont sighed. The comparison between himself and the gradation of decay which these columns exhibited was but too obvious and affecting. A few years, said he, and I shall become like the mortals on whose relics I now gaze. And like them, too, I may be the subject of meditation to a succeeding generation, which shall totter but a little while over the object they contemplate, ere they also sink into the dust. Retiring from the scene, he walked through the cloisters, till a door, which communicated with the lofty part of the building, attracted his curiosity. He opened this and perceived across the foot of the staircase another door. But now, partly checked by fear, and partly by the recollection of the surprise his family might feel in his absence, he returned with hasty steps to his carriage, having wasted some of the precious moments of twilight and gained no information.
And before we get him back to that carriage where they're waiting for him, tell us what you notice in the language there. It was very descriptive of the evening, of this decaying abbey. No, he's comparing his own body to the decaying church.
Yeah, it's so vivid. And I think part of why Radcliffe becomes almost like a cult figure is because she allows her readers to see this world. But one of the things I'm really struck by is this line, Lamotte's curiosity prompted him to explore further. And this is another kind of common feature of the Gothic. The curiosity of the characters impels them to go in that room where the reader knows
they
shouldn't
open that
go.
Door. That's right.
And I think this speaks to you, one of your earlier questions is like, why do readers, why do viewers like the Gothic, like horror so much? And part of it is that curiosity. We know we shouldn't open the door. We know we shouldn't go into that house. And yet we're curious. We want to see what lies beyond. Right, so the characters are curious. The readers are curious. So it gives this kind of energy and forward momentum, I think, to the narrative. Right, we want to keep reading.
Do you think we also want to sort of test to see that we're brave enough? You know, in other words, if we open that door and we face our fear, does that make us stronger? As opposed to just, okay, let's just not go to that haunted house. Let's not open the door.
Oh, I think so. I think there is a like, because we know... Even if this is very scary, it's still restrained. It's still constrained. Even if it's very, very scary, we know there's no real threat to us.
Now, this is also set outside of England, presumably in France.
Yes, it's set in France but in the 16th century.
The references to decay and sort of later generations, is there any sense at this point that there's kind of rottenness in England with the British Empire, and this is the time, after all, of slave trade starting to get questioned, and... Is there any sense that there's something, well, the way Shakespeare put, there's something rotten in the state of Denmark. Is there something rotten that's underneath some of this Gothic material?
I think so, but I think it's displaced, right? So this novel's published in 1791. It's 2 years after the French Revolution. So a lot of energy in England is spent thinking about and being afraid of that revolutionary impulse in France carrying over into England. Of course, we're also after the American Revolution. We're also after the Haitian Revolution. So there is a great deal of anxiety in England. And I think part of another reason why the Gothic novel really takes off in the 1790s is it's a way of displacing anxiety about revolution. Anxiety about what does it mean that more and more Britain is colonizing India, colonizing the West Indies, as now the major player in the slave trade. All these anxieties can't necessarily be explored in contemporary British literature. But if we go to France, or if we go to Italy, or if we go to Spain in the 16th century, we can explore these feelings, and they're not about us.
It's the other. Let's take a look at the way this chapter proceeds. So he's gone inside this decaying abbey or monastery, and he comes back to the carriage. You had mentioned this trope about the car that breaks down by the haunted house. And since it's the, you know, earlier time, we got a carriage, not a car.
Yeah. So Lamotte returns to the carriage. some slight answer to Madame Lamotte's inquiries, and a general direction to Peter to drive carefully on and look for a road was all that his anxiety would permit him to utter. The nightshade fell thick around, which, deepened by the gloom of the forest, soon rendered it dangerous to proceed. Peter stopped, but Lamotte, persisting in his first determination, ordered him to go on. Peter ventured to remonstrate. Madame Lamotte entreated, but Lamotte reproved, commanded, and at length repented, for the hind wheel rising upon the stump of an old tree, which the darkness had prevented Peter from observing, the carriage was in an instant overturned. The party, as may be supposed, was much terrified, but no one was materially hurt. And having disengaged themselves from their perilous situation, Lamotte and Peter endeavored to raise the carriage. The extent of this misfortune was now discovered, for they perceived that the wheel was broke. Their distress was reasonably great, for not only was the coach disabled from proceeding, but it could not even afford a shelter from the cold dews of the night, it being impossible to preserve it in an upright situation. After a few moments' silence, Lamotte proposed that they should return to the ruins which they had just quitted, which lay at a very short distance, and pass the night in the most habitable part of them. That when morning dawned, Peter should take one of the coach horses and endeavor to find a road and a town, from whence assistance could be procured for repairing the carriage. This proposal was opposed by Madame Lamotte, who shuddered at the idea of passing so many hours of darkness in a place so forlorn as a monastery. Terrors which she neither endeavored to examine or combat overcame her, and she told Lamotte she had rather remain exposed to the unwholesome dews of the night than encounter the desolation of the ruins. Lamotte had at first felt an equal reluctance to return to the spot, but having subdued his own feelings, he resolved not to yield to those of his wife.
So, of course, they have to go back inside?
Yes. So they go back to the abbey, the ruined abbey, which increasingly seems to be, and you never guess this, haunted.
Haunted. Of course it's haunted. And in this novel, Romance of the Forest, what are the sort of most striking features? You know, the way we had the giant helmet in Castle of Otranto that was 100 times the size you would expect that fell on someone and killed him. In this novel, what are the sort of supernatural features or ghostly, scary features that occur?
So throughout their stay in the monastery, there are all these things that seem to be supernatural. And then when Peter goes to town, everyone's like, oh, the abbey? We all know that's happened. So we all know that's haunted. So we also have that, like, the trope of, like, the townspeople or the villagers, like, oh, don't go to that castle. Don't go to that abbey. Don't go to that monastery. Don't go to that house. It's haunted. Right? So all those pieces are being set in place by Radcliffe.
Is some of this related to fairy tales? I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, the wicked stepmothers and the, you know, Beauty and the Beast and people being condemned to take a different shape and all kinds of things that seem to show up in fairy tales.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of the Gothic is this, you know, return to a medieval past, and a very often creative return to the medieval past, which we see also in a lot of these fairy tales, right? These fairy tales are also set sometime in the past.
Once upon a time.
Right? And so many of these Gothic novels similarly begin with this kind of like vague, like in the mists of times, these things happened.
Is there any sort of moral to the story? If you look at Castle of Otranto that we talked about before, or Romance of the Forest, is there a take-home lesson? Is there a moral?
There is. I mean, certainly Castle of Otranto is about, you know, not usurping, not taking what you shouldn't take. Don't, you know, Manfred's grandfather shouldn't have usurped the castle, but he did, right? And so the novel puts it to rights, and the castle ends up in the proper hands. So much of Radcliffe's fiction has to do really, I think, with how in extraordinarily difficult situations we rein in our emotions. Radcliffe is very interested in how we can be moral agents, how we can, even in these situations that draw all of our emotions, how can we control them? How can we rein them in so we can be moral, so we can be good, so we can make rational choices?
So we look at spooky things and terrifying things, but then we need to go back and function.
Yeah, right. And if you think about Radcliffe's heroines, like, they have to navigate difficult, challenging, dangerous situations where if they're entirely overcome by their emotions, they're not going to be able to do that.
We're going to look at a novel that actually spoofs Gothic novels, and that's one by Jane Austen, when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. A holiday ends as terror begins, stalking Catherine Morland from every shadowy corner of Northanger Abbey. Far from home and close to danger, Catherine has nowhere to turn. That's from a blurb advertising a paperback version of Jane Austen's Northanger Abbey, which is ironic since it was a novel that spoofed Gothic novels. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Mark Vareski, and we are talking about the Gothic novel. We've talked about Anne Radcliffe and about Horace Walpole. You've also mentioned your interest in the novel Northanger Abbey, which is really a different take on the Gothic novel. Tell us about why you would include that in this discussion that we're having.
Northanger Abbey is a fascinating novel because it's a novel about reading the Gothic novel. The main character, Catherine Morland, is an obsessive reader of the novels of Anne Radcliffe. She and her friend Isabella are reading like really trashy German Gothic novels. They're just voracious readers, and this isn't pejorative, like, they're fangirls in like the best possible way. They love these novels. They live for these novels. And so the Northanger Abbey becomes this like meditation about I think a love of reading and love for novels, but also kind of a cautionary tale about maybe not taking it too seriously.
So if you have Catherine Morland and she's read all these Gothic novels and then she winds up with an invitation to go to Northanger Abbey, what's in her head as she arrives there?
Oh, so Catherine is invited to Northanger Abbey by General Tilney. And General Tilney's son, Henry, is a boy that Catherine is very interested in. But Catherine is more interested in Northanger Abbey. And as soon as she hears the word Abbey, she thinks of ancient ruins, right? Something directly out of what we just read in Romance of the Forest. Secret passageways, creaky hinges, mysteries all around every corner.
Skeletons and murders and all kinds of hidden crimes.
Exactly.
And so what happens, or can you give us a passage from it or set it up so we understand what happens when Catherine arrives at Northanger Abbey and discovers she's not in a Gothic novel? She's in a Jane Austen novel.
Yeah, she's in a Jane Austen novel, right? We're not in medieval Italy or France or Spain. We're in 18th century England, right? So already the range of possibilities for spooky things happening is very low. And when she gets to the Abbey, she's expecting ruins and darkness, and it's actually clean and modern. And yes, it's a medieval building, but it's been modernized. But because she's a reader of the Gothic novel, she wants to enchant her world. So in her room, she spies this cabinet one dark and stormy night. Catherine's heart beat quick, but her courage did not fail her. With a cheek flushed by hope and an eye straining with curiosity, her fingers grasped the handle of a drawer and drew it forth. It was entirely empty. With less alarm and greater eagerness, she seized a second, a third, a fourth. Each was equally empty. Not one was left unsearched. Not one was anything found. Well read in the art of concealing a treasure, the possibility of false linings to the drawers did not escape her, and she felt round each with anxious acuteness in vain. The place in the middle alone remained now unexplored, and though she had never from the first had the smallest idea of finding anything in any part of the cabinet, and was not in the least disappointed at all in her ill success thus far, it would be foolish not to examine it thoroughly while she was about it. It was some time, however, before she could unfasten the door, and the same difficulty occurring in the management of the inner lock as of the outer. But at length it did open, not vain, as hitherto was her search. Her quick eyes directly fell on a roll of paper, pushed back into the further part of the cavity, apparently for concealment, and her feelings at that moment were indescribable. Her heart fluttered, her knees trembled, and her cheeks grew pale. She seized with an unsteady hand the precious manuscript. For half a glance sufficed to ascertain written characters. And while she acknowledged, with awful sensations, this striking exemplification of what Henry had foretold, resolved instantly to peruse every line before she attempted to rest. The dimness of the light her candle emitted made her turn to it with alarm, but there was no danger of its sudden extinction. It had yet some hours to burn, and that she might not have any greater difficulty in distinguishing the writing than what its ancient date might occasion, she hastily snuffed it. Alas! It was snuffed and extinguished in one. A lamp could not have expired with more awful effect. Catherine, for a few moments, was motionless with horror. It was done completely. Not a remnant of light in the wick gave hope to the rekindling breath. Darkness, impenetrable and immovable, filled the room. A violent gust of wind, rising with sudden fury, added to fresh horror to the moment. Catherine trembled from head to foot. In the pause which succeeded, a sudden sound, like receding footsteps and the closing of a distant door, struck on her affrighted ear. Human nature could support no more. A cold sweat stood on her forehead. The manuscript fell from her hand, and groping her way to the bed, she jumped hastily in and sought some suspension of agony by creeping far underneath the clothes.
And let's as we get this terror that's increasing, her heart's beating and so on, let's explain what actually does reveal itself the next day. What is it that she has found when the light shows that roll of paper?
Oh, it's just a list of linens.
It's a laundry bill. It's laundry. It's something written about laundry. So Jane Austen is doing what with a scene like that?
She's deflating it, right? She's setting us up. She's using all the ways that the Gothic works. It's a dark and stormy night. The light is flickering and then ultimately extinguished. There's an ancient manuscript. This is something that Radcliffe uses in all of her novels, where it's, you know, a letter written from someone who's being held imprisoned.
Catherine also thinks the general has murdered his late wife, which he has not. And there's all these other discoveries that she's not in a Gothic novel. But could you argue that maybe there is a kind of horror, the horror of the fact that the general only is interested in Catherine because he thinks she's rich, which she's not? You know, there's a class system. There's the way women are treated. Is there a different kind of horror at the heart of Northanger Abbey?
Absolutely. Catherine Morland thinks she's in a Gothic novel, so the horror is that Mrs. Tilney is dead or being imprisoned. But she's not, right? The horror is that the social world of 18th century England, basically a rather shady fellow, said, oh, she's going to inherit a lot of money. So General Tilney was like, oh, great, she's fit for my son. And then when he's disabused of that notion, she's cast out and she has to, like, basically take a wagon home in disgrace.
So he's not a murderer, but he's a jerk.
He's a jerk, right?
In the few minutes that we have left, can you say something about the Gothic novel and its impact on our own times or where we can find it, whether we turn on a TV or go to a theater, read a book? How is the Gothic novel that we started with Horace Walpole or Anne Radcliffe, how's it still with us?
It is everywhere. Anytime we watch a horror movie, anytime we watch like one of those like knights in armor movies or TV shows, the Gothic's with us, right? From Frankenstein to Dracula to any of the Jason movies, Friday the 13th, to the kind of like new horror genres that we're seeing from like, you know, all around us, right? Once we see how the Gothic novel works, we see it everywhere.
And do we continue to see spoofs of it as well?
Absolutely. I mean, just think about the Scream movies. Those are very much like Jane Austen reading the Gothic novel and responding to it in the early 19th century.
So on Halloween, as people head out in costumes, what should they think of themselves in terms of following in a line from the Gothic?
Anytime it's a dark and stormy night, the Gothic is with you.
And feel every moment of it. Mark Voreski has been my guest. Thank you for being with me, Mark, and showing us some incredible passages from Gothic novels.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.